What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I got to tell you, Anya, I didn't sleep well last night.
No? Why?
Trump has always had crazy rhetoric. You know, we listened to some of the deep cuts on Friday in a comedic way. Back from the Apprentice days. But the rhetoric over the weekend is escalating. It marks an escalation. And I wanted to take a minute today before we bring on an incredible lineup of guests to talk a little bit about what is called psychological priming. And psychological priming is a real thing. And just so everybody knows, I'm going to explain what psychological priming is. We're going to listen to some of what Donald Trump said over the weekend. We're going to put it in context. And we're going to talk about why it deeply matters. That it's not just, oh, it's another crazy thing he said. Psychological priming is this basic idea that exposure to sort of one kind of stimulus or statement may influence a response to a later stimulus or statement without an explicit call to action. Right. In other words, it's called seed. But you're planting the seed. That is psychological priming. So, for example, if you wanted a group of people to think that by storming a nation's capital during the counting of votes was an okay thing, you wouldn't say that right out of the box because that would sound nuts. But you would build up to it slowly by laying out the crumbs, by planting the seed, so that when it came time to do that, you would need to say just a couple of things that would, in a very deeply rooted, deeply patterned psychological response, make people do something that they probably otherwise wouldn't do. That might be out of line with who they are on an everyday basis. Because I just don't think we get very far by vilifying folks that may be inclined to like Donald Trump. I just don't think that helps because I don't think people set out with bad intent. But what Trump is masterful at is the constant, nearly eclipse-like psychological priming by saying all kinds of rhetorically escalating things. He has laid the seeds. He has left the crumbs for folks that are inclined to support him and maybe just your standard old conservatives to do and accept things that they would not ordinarily accept or support. And wouldn't if he just straight up said it out of the blue, right? That's the whole concept of psychological priming. And this weekend, you can see Trump, and I don't even know if he's doing this consciously, but I think as the pressures and the stressors of both his legal entanglements and as election season goes on, he slowly ratchets up the rhetoric. He certainly did it leading up to January 6th. Right. And we saw what happened. I don't believe that most of the people at the Capitol on January 6th, you know, the Proud Boys and the 3%ers sort of accepted, came there to commit crimes. They thought they were doing what was actually a defense of democracy because they had been psychologically primed to believe untruths and to then accept violent means of objection, of objecting or of their objection. I don't believe the vast majority of us think political violence is acceptable. You ask a person on the street, hey, when your guy loses an election, is it okay to burn down the state house? People are not going to say yes. I mean, that's not American. But you can, someone adept at psychological priming, whether he understands that he's doing that or not, you can get people to the place where it takes very little stimulus to go burn down the state house, to accept violence, to embrace violence to yourself and for yourself to become violent. And so I didn't sleep well last night because how do I talk about this stuff without vilifying folks who support Donald Trump? And I think trying to understand psychologically what's happening to us as a country, and I mean you, the listener, even if you hate Donald Trump, it's getting in there. You know, when we talk about the devolution or sort of how debased our political discourse has become, that's a version of psychological priming. We're getting primed to accept less and less and less from our candidates and our elected officials. It's why I try to scream from the mountaintop every time I can. Don't accept less. Actually, demand more. Demand greater integrity. Call out the failures on your own side as well, without succumbing to the doctrine of false equivalence. And psychological priming is the lock and stock and trade of every single historical movement of fascism and dictatorships and authoritarianism. It starts by planting the seeds that allow people to slowly, 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 and faster and faster accept more violent, more ludicrous, more anti-democratic, more racist, more misogynist, more hateful actions and policies. And we are in the midst of that. And Donald Trump is the master at this. As a historical point of fact, the Nazi Party came to power in Germany legally. They didn't overthrow the German governmental system. They psychologically primed the German people to otherize, to hate, to consider a group of people less than human. And what, my friends, are we hearing from Donald Trump every day? More and more of the otherizing, less than human. Anya, I know I didn't ask you for this, but we're going to get a couple of important messages in. In addition to this, the two statements that we're going to share with the audience in just a few moments, can you also see if you can find Trump referring to immigrants and migrants as not human, as animals? That was also from this weekend. This is the trade of totalitarianism. You give away a little bit of your common sense. You give a little bit of your soul slowly, 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 and then more quickly, because once you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. And this is what Trump was doing this weekend. Now, again, Democrat, Republican, Independent, I hate politics, wherever you may be. If you step back, don't listen to him. Read the transcript of what he says. Because Donald Trump never talks about actual policies. He never talks about details of how to make prescription drug prices better for Americans. He never talks about how he will actually protect America and our foreign policy interests, other than sort of these long stream of consciousness missives. But what he does do is prime each and every one of us, and the media included, to accept increasingly violent and increasingly hateful speech. Let's listen to what Donald Trump had to say about migrants and immigrants.
Election and called immigrants animals.
They've been treated terribly.
I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. These are animals, okay? If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands.
I mean, crack open your history book. What other groups of people have been referred to as animals, as subhumans?
As Untermensch, if you will, underhuman.
Right. Yeah. Whereas there were other people that were über alles.
Yeah.
Above all. Does this sound, I mean, this is dangerous. Like, big red flags here. And we can talk about, listen, a nation has to secure its borders. Yep, I agree with that. But we don't secure our borders by referring to other human beings as animals. That just foments violence and hatred. And let's take a listen on you if you've got it. I just, before we take a couple of messages, because I want to come back and talk about this more, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-75-CIVIC. How dangerous is this going to get, folks? How disturbing is this? Or have we become so numb to this psychological priming? Even people on the left, numbed by this. Here's what Donald Trump, and we're going to play two cuts back to back. Here's what he thinks is going to happen if he doesn't win.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
If this election
isn't won, I'm not sure that you'll ever have another election in this country. Does that make sense? I don't think you're going to have another election in this country. If we don't win this election, I don't think you're going to have another election, or certainly not an election that's meaningful.
I want you to keep these statements in your mind. We're going to take some messages. I want to hear from you if you'd like to chime in. How dangerous is it? How far has the bar dropped? Why is this acceptable? How did we get here? Tell me what you think. 855-75-CIVIC, because you all know I'm going to tell you what I think. 855-75-CIVIC. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm telling these tears go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flame. Welcome back, everybody. Yeah, how long must we point these things out? Donald Trump's language is meant to slowly, steadily, and assuredly convince everyone who either is on the fence or is already inclined to support him or to support conservative ideas that it is him and only him or the abyss. And because the choice is either him and only him or complete destruction of our country, it means that he can, should, and must win by any means necessary. He is priming his supporters and the country for not just another January 6th, but for a bloody November. That's what he's doing. By any means necessary, a bloodbath. If I don't win, there'll never be another election again? What are you even talking about? If you don't win, sir, is the only way that we can be absolutely certain that there will be elections again. His point is to evoke violence over and over and over again. And paint a picture of the total collapse of the United States unless he is basically installed as a leader forever. Because if what he was saying was actually true, how could anyone else ever lead the United States? If he's the only one that can save us from total annihilation, well, then obviously he should lead our country forever. Right? I mean, like, that's the outcome. That's the logical conclusion. I mean, he said in 2020, if Joe Biden's elected, there will be no school, no graduations, no weddings, no Thanksgiving, no Easters, no Christmas, no 4th of July, no future for the youth. That was kind of where this sort of rhetoric started. Get a little short of bloodbath. Like, there won't be anything good anymore in our country. That's what he's selling. And so you should do anything, including criminal violence, to ensure that I am the permanent leader of the United States. That is his objective. And recall, he began this speech in Ohio this weekend by physically saluting and thanking the January 6th Patriots. He already incited violence. What do you think he's doing now? Matt, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you?
Hello, Maggie. Thank you, Civic Media, for being a voice of reason. We need it. Far-right radio that's had the dominance over the airwaves for, I don't know, since I was a child. I'm 48. They're partially to blame for this, or completely to blame. Rush Limbaugh and others have been stoking fear in white men for, I don't know, decades now, and this is the culmination of that, combined with media. And I just want to, it's kind of fearful, or it's terrifying, really, because corporations are always complicit with fascism. They're comfortable with it. It just means a wider profit margin for them.
Well, I think,
Yeah,
go ahead. I'm sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to make a second point to mothers of young men, because I'm on YouTube, and I know this is very prevalent, and it's all over, but if they play those shooting video games that are ultra-violent, there's a lot of right-wing trolling on there to turn young men into MAGA-minded people who hate and, you know, downplay women and stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. A couple of things here. First, corporations aren't innately political. Corporations will lobby and take advantage of any sort of space to increase profit margins. Guess what's really easy when you have an authoritarian in charge? If you can help pay and support that authoritarian to stay in power, think Putin, that authoritarian can make whatever rules he or she wants by fiat to help enrich those corporations. It's a feedback loop. That's why Putin is so hard to remove, because there are, like, the entire political elite, the entire corporate elite of Russia, which is, it's completely enmeshed with Putin. That's what Donald Trump wants to create here. And that is not conservative. That's not Republican. It's not a republic at all. It's a regime that doesn't care anymore. For regular Americans, they'll feed you rhetoric. They'll scare the crap out of you so that you engage in violent behavior that you would never, ever think of doing, or that maybe someone you know might engage in violent behavior, and it's okay. So that they can set up a complete and total feedback loop between the corporate elite and the political elite. That not me and you, and this has nothing to do with Republican or Democratic. It's just the branding strategy. You catch my drift? Bob from Madison, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. Go ahead.
Well, I think the central thing you've got to worry about is convincing the MAGA people that the election of Biden was not illegitimate. They all think it's illegitimate. They bought all the big lie. That's fine. Day one of the January 6th commission is all devoted to all the aides, all the lawyers around him who told him this was crazy and that all of these theories he was coming up with didn't add up and didn't make any sense and wouldn't have a chance in court, and they didn't. And that is not widespread known among the MAGAs. That would be the first week of the D.C. trial if that ever goes to...
Well, isn't that the problem, right? The evidence is never going to see the inside of a courtroom before this election. Donald Trump and those that are complicit with him, especially within the federal judiciary, it's not happening. His Manhattan trial, that's pushed God knows how long. I don't think I can convince people that are walking around saying the election was stolen. I just can't, right? That's what I'm worried about are traditional Republicans, independents, those disengaged from politics, who think, oh, all politicians are, oh, it's all the same. Oh, it's all nonsense. It's not. This is not the same. Could you ever imagine Joe Biden being like, well, if I don't win, it'll be a bloodbath. Stand back and stand by. It just, it's only the MTGs. It's only the DJTs. It's only the Matt Gaetzes that engage this rhetoric. Why? Because when you can't win fair and square, you cheat. And you cheat in Donald Trump's escalating language by priming all of us psychologically, mentally, step by step, teaspoonful by tablespoonful, by cupful, by gallon, by fire hose full of violent, xenophobic, homophobic, misogynistic rhetoric that the vast majority of us would never condone if said out of the blue by someone in our family, in our offices, on a playground, or in our churches, synagogues, and mosques. I'm Maggie Dunn. Keep it locked. We're going to take some important messages, including the all-important farm update here in the state of Wisconsin. We'll be back with more in a moment. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Really excited to be joined this half hour by a former colleague of mine and a long-serving local elected official, Alderman Bob Bauman from the City of Milwaukee. Welcome, Bob.
Glad to be on. Welcome to you and hello to all your listeners.
Wonderful to have you. How long have you been an alderman, Bob?
I was first elected in April of 2004, so we're going on 20 years.
Two decades in public service. What's the most important thing to be a successful alderman?
To listen to your constituents, to be responsive, to make sure city services are being delivered in an efficient and prompt way. To always be transparent, to be straightforward, and pretty much to do the job as the job is designed.
I think that's great. To folks that live in smaller jurisdictions, do you have some words of wisdom about how to suss out, how to evaluate whether or not this candidate or that candidate is a good representative locally or will be a good representative? Are there indications? How do they know if somebody's going to do the job as it was intended?
Well, I think you look at someone's background to start out. I mean, when I was first elected, I've been an attorney. I was graduated from law school in 1977, so I've technically been licensed to practice law going on, well, close to 50 years, actually, 47 years. I practiced for 14 years between 1990 and 2004. And then I also practiced law between 1977 and 1983. So I actually practiced for about 18, 19 years of that time. And I make the same comparison to constituents. I mean, as an attorney, you're essentially an advocate for your client. Your job is to assess your client's problem, what the challenges are ahead, what remedies they may have available to them, and represent their best interests, whether it be through a court, whether it be against the opposition, whoever the opposition may be. There may be litigation where there's another party on the other side of the case. It may be a transactional situation where you're negotiating some sort of transaction with somebody who's adverse to you. You want to buy something, somebody wants to sell something to you, vice versa. And it's similar. What I do in this job is similar to that. You're an advocate. Where you identify a problem, you listen, you determine what the remedies are, and you try to find the solution that satisfies the constituent or client. And I really have viewed the voters of the 4th Aldermanic District as essentially clients. That's the representational part of the job.
Yeah.
There's also the public policy part. There's the budget part. You know, there's all the other things that we do. But in terms of our dealing with our constituents, with the voters, it's very simple. So I would look at somebody's background. You know, what in their past has equipped them to serve as an advocate that would qualify them to work as an advocate? Look at their past to determine how they're likely to perform going forward.
I think it's really interesting because you brought up some of the most technical elements of being a local elected official. And I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit, how do you and how have you over time engaged with budgets? Like, how do you figure out, is this a good budget? What should I amend? How do I know if this is going to work in the long term or even short term for the city or your particular 4th Aldermanic district?
Well, the budget at the city of Milwaukee is, the council has a relatively small amount of maneuvering space. A tremendous amount of the budget is baked in. And by that, I mean a tremendous amount is personnel costs.
Yes.
The wages and benefits of employees. And that's approximately 80% of the city's budget. And unless you're facing a budget that is calling upon major layoffs or major increases, you pretty much have baked in those personnel costs. Same with equipment costs. I mean, you have a certain amount of motor vehicles in your fleet. You're going to have a certain amount of fuel needed to propel those vehicles. So a lot of the budget, you know, out of the city's general purpose budget, which is about $699 million, the overall budget is $1.9 million, but the council does not have a lot of direct control over some aspects of that budget. We have a lot of control over the general purpose budget, which funds everything people associate with city services: fire, police, libraries, health department, Department of Neighborhood Services, Department of City Development. And of that budget, typically in my 20 years, we have dealt with maneuvering room of under $10 million.
Yeah, it's on
year.
The margin. For people who haven't been engaged directly with local governments, whether it's the city or a northern town, village, et cetera, the way I'm trying to ask this question, I'm going to stop trying to ask it really diplomatically. And I know you're a straight talker, Bob. I wonder, what's your tolerance or what's your read on basically local elected officials overselling what they can do, promising a lot, and they're not being real candid about the fact that there is, in most cases, sort of that limited margin that they can impact? What are the ways, if it's not through the budget, how do people suss out, like, hey, is this person selling me a bill of goods? What should and can constituents ask their local elected officials that will be impactful in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I think that the first question should be to that prospective official, that candidate, is please explain to me the budget process and have them demonstrate a knowledge of how the budgets are prepared. Because here in the city of Milwaukee, the way our budget is prepared is there's an entire department under the mayor's control called the Office of Management and Budget. And they employ a good 20, 30 people whose primary task is to prepare the executive budget. And that takes a full 9 months of the year. That executive budget is basically the mayor's proposed budget. That is not submitted to the council until approximately September of each year. And then the council has exactly about 1 month to 6 weeks to analyze that budget, hold hearings, bring every department in to explain what they're asking for and why. And then it comes to the council for amendments. And then it comes to us for final approval. So the administration has an opportunity to craft what is essentially 98% of the budget. And when it comes to the council, as I say, so much of it is baked in that we're able to deal with a small portion. There may be an amendment It may move $3 or $4 or $5 million, $6 million one way or another. But the vast majority of the budget is pretty much baked in, unless the council wants to really start tearing things apart and breaking them down to scratch. That has really never happened in probably modern times.
Yeah.
Maybe 100 years ago that happened.
Yep.
But that really doesn't happen today. A, the council doesn't have the staff. So I would ask that official, explain how the budget is created. And then having explained it, tell me how you're going to turn the Queen Mary on a dime.
Yes.
How you are going to turn... turn lead into gold, as you're proposing to tell us. Where are you going to find the money? What do you do with all those expenses that are baked in? Where do you find the new money? Are you going to raise the tax levy? Oh, there's tax levy limits. You can't raise the tax levy beyond the value of new construction. Oh, okay. Well, how are you going to raise the money for these new services? Are you going to wait? The federal government's going to pay for it? What program? What grants? ARPA money? What? American Rescue Plan. I hate using acronyms because...
acronym salad.
Right. So I mean, and I think you have to have somebody explain how they think it works, and how they think how it works is going to allow them to do what they're promising to do.
I think that's so important. Ask them how they're going to pay for it. Do you understand how things get paid for in government? It's very easy to say, I'm going to do all these wonderful things for you, but it has to get paid for somehow. And one of my greatest frustrations, having worked in local government for a long time, was the bloviating overpromiser who knew damn well they couldn't find the money for that if they had all year and a staff of 100 people, because it just ain't there. Government doesn't have a money tree. We're fiduciaries to taxpayer dollars, and we have to make those budgets work at the end of the day. Bob, you've had a reputation as being... sometimes a pain in people's butts because you're so upfront and direct and clear. I hope you don't mind my saying that. When people tell that to me, I take it as a compliment, high praise. So from one pain in the butt to the other.
Fair enough.
Why and how do you continue to have the energy to be that truth teller, to call things out? You've done this for 20 years. I haven't ever seen you slow down one little bit or hesitate one bit on calling out the baloney, as it were. How do you maintain that energy? How do you keep telling truth to people even when it's hard for folks to hear?
Well, I guess it's my nature. I mean, I've always believed in intellectual honesty, number one. And, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, I don't suffer fools, and I like people to be transparent. And if somebody doesn't have an answer, okay, I can accept that, but don't try to give me an answer that I know is probably not complete or not accurate. I like to see the bureaucracies execute. You know, it's one thing, councils are very good, legislative bodies generally, whether it's Congress, state legislature, city councils. I mean, they're very good at formulating policy, enacting policy. But most policies require execution, and that is in the hands of the bureaucracies. And so much of the time, legislative bodies will pass a law, they'll pose for holy pictures, have a groundbreaking, have a signing, and then everything just sort of stops. It doesn't ever get executed. It doesn't ever get acted upon. And so part of my job, I've always viewed, not only do I enjoy and thrive on the policy part of the job, but making sure bureaucracies follow through and execute the policies, because that can sometimes get lost, especially at the local level. And then people wonder, well, I thought you made a policy that required this or that to happen, and it's never happened, because sometimes the bureaucracy will drop the ball. Now, technically, the bureaucracies are under the control of the chief executive officer, in other words, the mayor. You know, I employ exactly one person reports to me, and that's my legislative assistant. Whereas there are 7,400 people that report to the mayor. The entire rest of the city bureaucracy technically reports to the mayor through his department heads. And, you know, they are responsible for executing the policies we enact, and of course the policies that the mayor wants to pursue as well. So that's where the pain in the butt part comes in, when we kind of bird dog the bureaucracies to perform.
To be accountable to the policies.
Absolutely. And that's where the pain in the butt thing comes in. I mean, legislating is not that painful, and that's dealing with my other 14 colleagues. But when you're dealing with trying to get a Department of Public Works to move on a particular project or move on a particular policy, or Department of Neighborhood Services or the health department, or the libraries. And you find in government, and this is true up and down the entire
Fed, state, the
entire
local
ladder of
state,
and at the federal level, you know, you hear talk about the deep state at the federal level. Well, you know, as much as I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, that's one thing he's right about. There is a deep state out there, and there is this massive bureaucratic apparatus that is truly huge at the federal level. And yeah, they can, you know, Congress can pass a law, but well, when do we get around to executing? And take us a couple of years to promulgate rules, and then some more years to prepare the paperwork and the forms.
Yeah, they can slow walk, they can speed up, they can. And that's, I hear you saying that one of the questions that constituents should be asking, whether it's of a candidate or an incumbent, is how did you follow up on this enacted legislation or this policy objective?
Right.
And how are you helping to ensure that the executive branch is indeed executing? We're going to take a couple of important messages, Bob. We'll be back because I want to ask you about this reelection campaign. I really appreciate it. From one pain in the butt to another, I love you. I love that you will say what needs to be said. I'm Maggie Dawn. I'm talking with City of Milwaukee Alderman Bob Bauman, 20-year public servant. You're not going to want to miss what he or I have to say coming up next after these important messages here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm talking to long-serving City of Milwaukee Alderman Bob Bauman, who is known for helping hold administrations going back to Mayor Meyer's time through John Norquist, Mayor Barrett, and now, of course, Mayor Cavalier Johnson's administration accountable to the legislature.
Well, that's Mayor Meyer. I don't go back to Mayor
You
Meyer.
Don't go back to, okay, so that's just my dad. But for those
or the Norquist,
yeah,
yes.
For those that don't know, my dad was a long-serving City of Milwaukee employee. He worked in the comptroller's office, and he started under Mayor Meyer, who I think was the longest-serving mayor in the history of the United States. We have long-termers in the City of Milwaukee, right?
Yeah, 1960 to 1988. Henry Meyer served.
I mean, that's incredible. Sorry, I didn't mean to add any extra years. So you've seen now three administrations. And we've been talking about holding the administration accountable. You've had some pretty public tussles with the city attorney, Bob, who's also up for re-election this spring on April 2nd. I've spoken about the incumbent in that position on my show. How do you think folks should approach these technical elected official offices, like a comptroller, which is the chief money manager of the city, or a chief legal officer, also known in Milwaukee as the city attorney? How do people get to figure out, hey, is this person competent? Are they a good manager? Do they understand the subject matter?
That is a very good question. With the comptroller, I would look at someone's credentials, their resume. Over the course of their previous career, have they been in a position to know the job, to do the job, to understand the job? In the case of Bill Christensen, he has. I mean, he's younger, but he certainly has the credentials and the academic background to perform the work. And he's been in the budget office for many years. He's been the deputy controller, the number two person in the office for many years. And, you know, clearly those are solid qualifications. And so, there you go. I mean, in that case, it's relatively straightforward. He's got a resume. He's got a history. He's got on-the-job experience in the position or essentially in the same realm as what he's running for. In the case of city attorney, it's a very different animal because there I think you have an individual who is kind of a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he back in 2020, when he was running, nobody quite knew who he was, but there were some concerns with the incumbent, Grant Langley. and some concerns on the council. And frankly, I think there was an appetite for a change. There was an appetite for a fresh perspective, because the city attorney plays an absolutely critical role in the day-to-day functioning of the city. And so Mr. Spencer won. And of course, okay, well, at some point we assume he's going to make the rounds to acquaint himself with certainly the council, because he's going to be working with us extensively. If he understood what the job was, he would know he'd be working with the council extensively. And to this day, I have never had a one-on-one conversation with Chairman Spencer, ever.
It's incredible to me because I did effectively his job at the county, and I talked to a county board supervisor, your equivalent at the county, basically every day. I had some meeting, phone call, face-to-face with the legislators.
He's essentially taken an adversarial role to his client, in essence. He has stated in writing that he does not believe he represents the officers and agents of the city of Milwaukee, that he only represents the city as an entity, as a municipal corporation. Apparently, he doesn't realize that entities, whatever they are, whether they're Standard Oil or whether they're a Ma and Pa grocery store, can only operate through human beings, through their agents and employees. He literally takes the position that he doesn't represent aldermen.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Lawyerless. I mean, we for the last 4 years, we have felt that we didn't even have an attorney.
Yeah.
And so we grappled with hiring outside attorneys to represent us in different situations. We've literally had adverse proceedings with our own lawyer in several different contexts, and some quite bizarre. He's openly attacked his client, namely members of the Common Council. He's accused us of being under investigation when there are no such investigations.
Yes.
I mean, it is literally kind of bizarre, almost like he's in a different sense of reality. And he's very Trump-like in the sense that he takes responsibility for nothing. Somebody else is always at fault. It's either the media's fault that he's had these difficulties. It's the former city attorney and his supporters, they're at fault. The lack of the pay is too low, and that's the reason people are leaving. It's always someone else. He dodges any responsibility whatsoever and seems to live in a semi-dream world. Because he doesn't come to committee meetings anymore. He sends his deputies, which I guess is fine. But, you know, once in a while, Grant Langley would appear in person to deal with an issue, if it seemed to be an issue of some magnitude. Chairman Spencer, I don't believe, has ever appeared in person before the Judiciary and Legislation Committee, which is the committee that most regularly deals with the city attorney. He may have appeared virtually some time ago, but he has not appeared in person or virtually in at least two and a half years.
And just to give people a frame of reference, I did every cycle in person or when we were in COVID via Teams. Again, it's anathema. And basically, I'll just say this. It is a complete violation of a lawyer's duty of loyalty and our duty to serve to attack your clients. And it is an especially pernicious violation of that when you do that as a public lawyer. That is not the place of a public lawyer. I will say it because I was one. We do not choose and get to choose, pick which clients we like and don't like. They're all of our clients because corporations aren't people and corporations act through individuals. Bob,
Absolutely correct. We've
got just about a minute left. You're up for re-election again. Tell people why they should vote for Alderman Bob Bauman for re-election on April 2nd.
Well, I know how the city works. I know how to get things done. I've worked tirelessly to expand affordable housing, to expand home ownership. I've worked to reduce the reckless driving that's plaguing our city. I've worked to create family-supporting jobs through various legislative measures. And I've supported economic development initiatives that have grown the city's tax base, which allows us to fund our public services and expand those services.
I love you, Bob. Keep doing the good work. You'll always have my vote and support, and you'll always have a mic here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Thank you so much for your time, Bob. Keep up the good fight. We'll be back with more after the top of the hour news, weather, and sports here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. I hit a problem in the early hours, so stopped it dead for a beat or two. Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo. But I cut some cord, and I shouldn't have done it, and it won't forgive me after all these years. Ooh-hoo.